This podcast of the Radio Cafe comes to you via radiocafe.org, where you can find more information and many other podcasts. Technical support comes from Studio X, providing website design, hosting, e-commerce, and social media marketing, serving Santa Fe to the world since 1994. Find out more at studiox.com. I'm delighted now to welcome back to the Radio Cafe Benny Benedetti. He is founder and artistic director of the Actors Lab, which is a new company opening here in Santa Fe. Jonathan Richards, longtime actor, is a member of that company. Welcome, gentlemen, to the Radio Cafe.
Hi, Mary Charlotte.
Glad to be here.
So, Santa Fe, lots of theater these days.
Yes.
Tell us about the new company.
There is sort of a renaissance going on in Santa Fe. It's quite exciting. The one thing that we didn't have that I've been thinking about starting for years, my wife and I got here about 6 years ago, and I was expecting to see lots of theater going on because the three equity companies that have existed in Santa Fe over the years, the New Mexico Stages, the Santa Fe Rep.
Santa Fe Stages, New Mexico, Rep.
I always get them confused.
And then there was also, there have been a couple of other things, the Festival Theater.
The Shakespeare Festival was equity in its last year, I think.
There was the British American Theater Institute, perhaps before your time.
Before. Anyway, the three that we just mentioned were started by students of mine.
Ah.
And the start of the Santa Fe Shakespeare Festival, when it was over in the park,
was Steve Schwartz,
who was also a student of mine. So I came into town expecting to see all this theater going on, and it wasn't there until recently. But there were wonderful actors like Jonathan and Nicholas Ballas, who was a student of mine at Cal Arts. And Skip Rappaport, the ubiquitous lighting designer here in town, who was also a student of mine. So I was eager to get these folks together, along with like-minded people, to start a company that would be actor-centered, in the sense that, and this is what distinguishes us from the other operations in town, I think, is that I pick shows for specific actors.
Ah, interesting.
And I think, Suzanne Lederer and Tone Forest would be wonderful in Driving Miss Daisy. And Jonathan, and then we were lucky enough to find Talis and Nico, and so we did Sylvia, and I thought, that's a great bunch of people. I'd like to do another show with them. So what we do is, in the model of the old 1950s idea of the resident company, where you have a group of actors and then you cast your entire season out of that group of actors. And in the 50s and 60s, we tried very hard in America to start that kind of theater, which is really on a European model. And what we didn't remember was that in Europe, those theaters are all heavily subsidized by the governments.
Right.
And so very few of those companies have survived. In fact, in terms of having a resident company on year-round contract, I think maybe the Arena Theater in Washington might be the only one left.
What about the Bill Ball in San Francisco?
The ACT was a company for many years, and then they couldn't sustain it economically. And someone just told me that the Guthrie, which was one of the oldest and longest-lived resident companies, is now no longer a resident company. But they, you know, it's a lot economically, it's a lot more feasible to job actors in as needed show by show rather than trying to carry a resident company for an entire season.
As an actor, people often ask you, I don't know how you learn all those lines. And I remember when I did Summer Stock back in the early 60s, it was that same kind of program that Benny's describing, a resident company. And Summer Stock actors would be performing one show, at the same time they're rehearsing another show and they're learning the lines for the show after that.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I worked in that system early on. PCPA in Solvang and Santa Maria, which had a resident company, we would be doing six shows, so that there were sometimes people involved in as many as four shows, one of them usually a musical. And actors grow artistically in that environment like plants in a hothouse. It's incredible the amount of growth that occurs. It's much greater than in any kind of training program. My first directing job was at the Great Lakes Shakespeare Festival in its early, early years in Cleveland. And we did one-week rep Shakespeare. We'd come in and we would have five rehearsals total to mount to Shakespeare. We'd rehearse Monday through Thursday, and then everybody would perform. And the following Wednesday night, we'd open. And it was an incredible experience. The actors had to come with their lines already learned.
Yeah.
You would block at the first rehearsal and then try to create the show thereafter.
But Benny talks in terms of actors growing in this environment, and I think that's really where the title of our company, New Mexico Actors Lab, fits, because it is a lab in which, like in a petri dish, these actors develop develop greater qualities and strengths.
That straw hat, what used to be called the straw hat circuit in the summer times. I worked at one in Hinsdale, Illinois, called Salt Creek Summer Theater, that was run by a wonderful old actor named Sidney Blackmer. And that tradition of the summer festival, Provincetown Players, Williamstown Theater Festival, and so on, is one that's just barely hanging on in America. And it's an opportunity, especially for students in training, to have practical experience during the summers. So I wanted to do a company that would do a season, and as we discussed at our board meetings, three shows is about the least number of shows that you can call a season. But I wanted to do them in a compressed period of time. So we're doing three shows in 3 months in the summer, and then the problem became where to do it, which in Santa Fe is a problem no matter when you want to do theater. We have so few venues.
And there are such hugely varied sizes. I mean, you can be in the Lensic and have over 800 seats, or you can be in a very small space.
Which we are in.
Which you are in.
Yeah, we're in the smallest.
Yeah.
56 seats is really comfortable in Paraguas.
Teatro Paraguas is where your home
Yes, because they had no particular plans for summer activity, because until recently they had no air conditioning. So they were very happy to have us in for the entire summer. It also will be a chance for them to introduce themselves as a venue to a new audience base. They've been so far focused mainly on bilingual theater work. And it's a win-win for all of us. So I had two conditions under which I had to select the shows for the season, and which we did cooperatively. One was working with a small group of actors, and second was fitting into a very small performance space and picking plays that would benefit from the intimate kind of acting that's required by the fact that the audience is in some cases 6 or 8 feet away from the actors.
Right.
And I think the three plays that we've selected, all of which have won major prizes, either the Tony or the Pulitzer or both, as in the case of Proof, very small casts. Proof has the biggest cast with 4 people.
The other two have 3.
Yeah, Driving Miss Daisy and Art are each 3 people. John is I'm the only repeat.
Yeah,
he's doing
cast.
Two of the shows. I would like to have done more repeats, but it just didn't work out schedule-wise because actors have to have other lives here in Santa Fe.
And also there are physical, there are age and type requirements that the parts call for.
Are you really casting age appropriately, which often doesn't happen in Santa Fe?
Oh, yes. Yes, all across the board, I would say. Yeah.
I'm really glad to hear that.
Yeah.
Let's talk about the first play, Proof, which is opening on May 26th and running through June 12th. A nice run, a lot of chances to see it. I saw that as a movie. It is a stunning and fascinating movie. Who ever thought you could make a math play?
Yes. Who was in the movie? Was that
Gwyneth Paltrow?
And Anthony Hopkins was the father.
And
I've never seen the movie.
And I think was it Jake Gyllenhaal? Was Hal?
It was indeed Jake Gyllenhaal.
Yeah.
So tell us a little bit about the play.
The play is, as you say, it's a math play. I have found in my theater going that science plays, math plays can be fascinating dramatic vehicles in the same way that there seems to be a very close relationship between science and music, especially improvisational music and jazz. There's a very good dramatic tension that seems to come with plays like Copenhagen, for instance, about Niels Bohr and Heisenberg. And I've seen several others, a play about Richard Feynman, which I can't now remember the name of it, but they seem to, that discipline seems to seems to offer a playwright great opportunity for dramatic tension.
Which is interesting because there's a lot of, and again, I'm not so sure about plays, but in terms of cinema, there have been a lot of movies made about artists, and they almost uniformly are awful.
The Agony and the Ecstasy?
Well, the movies about Gertrude Stein or movies about, the Anthony Hopkins Picasso actually wasn't that bad.
And Woody Allen's Midnight in Paris was actually terrific.
Right, but that was not trying to be a serious movie about artists.
No,
I mean, that
no.
like took that period and riffed on it.
Well, but don't forget Ed Harris's Jackson Pollock movie, which was very good.
Yeah.
Marsha Gay Harden.
Another former student of Benny's.
Yeah, and one of the supporters of our theater.
The math in this is a vehicle. The audiences should not feel they're going to be subjected to theorems and mathematical calculations.
The math is actually a small part.
There will be no quiz.
There will not be a quiz. There will be no final exam. But the math serves as what it serves is as is a mystery. That's the value of the math. It's the mysterious quality of genius that he's exploring in this play.
And equally, the play explores the relationship between madness and genius, in the same way that A Beautiful Mind did. There seems to be, statistically, a pretty high correlation between artistic genius and scientific genius and madness, perhaps because at the highest levels, they all involve confrontations with the unknown, and that produces a great deal of anxiety. So that artists and scientists have suicide rates and mood disorder rates that are much higher than the general population.
Which is not to say all artists and great mathematicians or scientists are crazy, because the majority of them are not, but still, it's higher than, way higher than average.
Well, one of the things that comes out in this play, in Proof, which we will repeat where it's opening and when, but in Proof, the distinction, one of the conflicts and distinctions in it is between the run-of-the-mill level of talent in mathematics and then the genius level of talent in mathematics. It's very clear that there are workmanlike people who do the legwork and do the day-to-day work in the field, but then there are these Mozarts who come along and just push it forward in a quantum leap.
And one of them, it turns out to be female, in what is a field dominated by males.
Right.
So it's also the play also has a feminist dimension. Can we recognize genius in a woman as readily as we are willing to recognize it in a man?
Right.
And that's sort of the central question of the mystery surrounding this incredible mathematical theorem that appears. Is it likely that this famous mathematician's daughter could have written this? But certainly the unwillingness of the scientific community to accept the genius of a woman, and a young woman at that, is certainly a major theme of the play.
There's also historical reference to a woman, an 18th century young woman, who is sort of, in a way, the model for the character in this play.
Yeah.
And it's also not unlike the character in the great Tom Stoppard play Arcadia, who is a self-taught mathematical genius who, you know, there's a certain correspondence. They're very different plays, but a correspondence in those two characters.
Was the 18th century woman Lord Byron's daughter?
No, she's a French woman. I'm drawing a blank now on the name.
Sophie Germain.
Sophie okay. Germain. And she apparently developed her skills just because she was kind of shut away. It was during the French Revolution, and you couldn't get out much, so she spent her time just working on math theory, and then she started corresponding with a famous mathematician who assumed she was a young man.
And she was using a male
pseudonym.
Yeah.
And finally, a mutual friend said to the famous mathematician, you know, this brilliant young man you're corresponding with is a young woman. And he was, you know, flabbergasted, but rose to the occasion.
And she tried to go to school, but women were not allowed at that time. So in the modern setting of proof, our heroine is likewise shut away, not by the French Revolution, but by the need to care for her insane father, played by Jonathan. And she too, like Sophie Germain, stays sane and develops theorems about prime numbers. It's interesting that they both, well, I'm sure that was on purpose by David Auburn, the playwright. They both developed famous theorems about prime numbers.
But I think part of what Auburn is getting at is, don't think the proposition I'm putting forth, this feminist proposition I'm putting forth in this play, is fantastical. It has historical underpinnings.
Exactly. And Talis Rose, a wonderful actress, plays the lead role
in
the play Proof, and we saw her in that wonderful play Sylvia, where she played a dog, it was just stunning.
She goes from a dog to a mathematical genius. She has a great range.
And Jonathan was her partner in both cases, her owner in Sylvia and
That's
her father right. in Proof.
Now, what is it like for you? And for both of you, and this is sort of what you were talking about before, having a resident company, not only are you casting for that company, but the actors are really getting to know each other, starting to act as an ensemble. And I have seen both in theater and in film the chemistry that develops among actors who've known each other and worked together for a long time is something very special on stage.
Oh, yes, it is. And there's no substitute for it. That was part of our dreams for the resident theater movement in the 50s and 60s, that actors could not only grow individually, but they could learn the communication skills and the camaraderie of company membership. And most of those early resident theaters, like the one at the Guthrie and like ACT, had classes. In fact, the original Lort League of Resident Theater contract allowed for classwork to be a part of the paid requirements, the contractual requirements of the actors in the company. That only lasted a few years. But as you say, that was part of the artistic ferment that can occur in a resident company situation. You also, when you're doing a season of however many plays, and in the professional world, six was a most common number. My friend Donovan Marley, who ran the PCPA, Pacific Conservatory of the Performing Arts in Solvang and Santa Maria in California, out of the six plays, he had developed a sort of formula. Two of them were musicals, and they would attract the audience base, really. Three remaining ones were what he called evergreens, you know, Glass Menagerie, Beth of a Salesman, that kind of show. And then one, and sometimes two, were either brand new plays or extremely challenging plays. And having a relationship to a community over a number of years, part of the responsibility of a theater group is to elevate the taste and the sophistication of its audience. And the idea of having a subscription, getting people to commit to attending the entire season, gives you the opportunity of sneaking in a couple of really challenging plays that right. might not survive on their own.
But it's also the other challenge and responsibility of a theater group like this, and really of any theater, and this has been the problem in my, you know, the decades that I've been in Santa Fe and seeing Santa Fe theater, is that you have to not only perhaps raise and educate an audience, but more important, you have to develop a trust with the audience. You have to convince the audience that when you go to see this theater company, you're going to see something of quality. And that has been the problem, that uneven quality has really been a problem. Audiences go, they see a pretty good show, so they go the next time and they see something that they can't imagine why it was even put up on a stage. And so that burns an audience, and the audience tends to turn away. So what you have to do is to create a consistency of quality. Not everything is going to be as good as the last one or the next one, but it all has to be. There has to be an assurance of a certain level. When I go to this theater, it's not going to be an evening wasted. It's going to be an evening well spent. I'd like to also mention, we haven't mentioned the other two members of the cast of this show, and they're both very good. One is a young man named Jeffrey Pomeroy, which I think has star written all over the name. Jeffrey Pomeroy is a wonderful name. I think Jeffrey is somebody whose career is, you know, is beginning, and we'll hear more from him.
He's fairly new to Santa Fe.
He's pretty new to Santa Fe. We actually met at a party. I was introduced to him by the host, who said, I'd like you to meet this young actor. And I said, do you want to do theater? And he said, absolutely. So I put him together with Benny. And the other is Jody Durham, who plays the sister in this play. And I had not known her before this, but she's doing a wonderful job in it.
Yeah, she is. I'm very glad to have them in the group. And I should also mention the other, there's only two other members of the entire company. Scott Harrison of Ironweed, who is going to play the son in Driving Miss Daisy, the part that Dan Aykroyd played in the movie, and Nicholas Ballas in Art, we've mentioned. And the other person we haven't mentioned is your compatriot on the New Mexican
Robert
staff.
Not only my compatriot, but
my compatriot as well. Many years doing Speaking of the Arts on this program.
Yeah. So it's a wonderful group of people.
And the terrific actors Suzanne Lederer and Tone Forrest.
I picked Driving Miss Daisy for them. Tone is a feature of, they both are features of Santa Fe Theater over a number of years. I first saw Tone myself as the stage manager in our town in Scott Harrison's production
of it.
And also a little show called Salt and Pepper, which is about age. That was the first show that I saw at the Teatro Paraguas years ago. Suzanne Lederer, I've known for a long time. She is a Broadway actress transplanted to Santa Fe and here for many years. They've had the problem of being equity actors, as I am, and because of the equity rule, we're not permitted to work for free. I have been an equity member for over 26 years, and I had gone on what's called honorable withdrawal, where I was no longer bound by the equity rules. But when the Fusion Theater cast me as the father in Outside Mullingar last season, was it last season?
Yes.
I renewed my membership, forgetting that it was going to cut me off from being able to do a lot of work, a lot of non-equity work here. So in order to do Driving Miss Daisy, we had to find a co-producer sponsor to underwrite the equity salary, because that will be an equity show. With only 56 seats, there was no way that we could afford to pay equity salaries. But Walter Diltz, who created the Red Thread Collective years ago with Tone and Craig Barnes, primarily to do Craig Barnes's plays originally, and they've been producing here in Santa Fe for 13, 15 years.
Something like that, yeah.
And Walter kindly offered to underwrite the equity salaries for Driving Miss Daisy. We couldn't have done it without him. So I'm very happy for that connection, too.
We're talking to Benny Benedetti and Jonathan Richards about the New Mexico Actors Lab. You said something, Benny, before we started talking today, that in your many years directing and working with actors, you've learned not only what to say to actors, but what not to say to actors. And I wondered if you could talk about that a little bit.
Well, I subscribe to the mushroom theory of directing. Keep them in the dark, shovel in the manure, and watch them grow. As a result, over the years, what I've learned is to shut up and get out of the way of actors. If the casting is correct, and this is what works for me. If the casting is direct, I wrote a book about directing, and the first thing that it says is directing is the art of correcting the mistakes that you made in casting. The better the casting, the less directing is required. I worked with, when I was teaching at Carnegie, I worked with a director named Word Baker, who was the original director
of
the Fantastics. And Word had a really simple casting method. He would simply keep firing actors until he found somebody who did the job. That's Proviso 1. Casting, and Proviso 2 is the ground plan. That's why I insist on designing the shows that I direct, as I'm designing all three of the shows this summer. If I get the ground plan correct, then the actor's impulse to move can generate the kind of blocking that works visually with very little editing on my part. So with those two ingredients in place, there is not a lot of directing needed. And as a result, I got to meet Peter Brook once a long time ago, and he tells a story about his first chance to direct. He had prepared his Reggie book, his King book, as it was called in those days, which had all of his notes and ideas for blocking and so on written in it. And it was some big classic play. And he realized early into the rehearsal process that he hadn't even once looked at the stage. He had been so busy looking into this book that he barely knew what the actress looked like. And he closed the book and never opened it again and has never had a book again. That's the way I work. I go into rehearsal. Some nights I can barely remember what play we're doing. I mean, I'm just there watching what's in front of me and responding to it. And most of the time not sharing. The other thing that I've learned about directing is that if you don't give a note the first time that you notice it, or the second time, or maybe the third or fourth time, the chances are that it will go away. It'll clear itself up. And that's far preferable to my calling something to someone's attention. So I will have to see a problem that becomes chronic, that, you know, becomes embedded in the performance before I will go in and request an adjustment. Because if I give an actor a note, that's a piece of baggage that they have to carry into the performance. They get to that point and there's a little voice in the back of their head that sounds a lot like me saying, now remember to go behind the sofa at this point, which is the last thing an actor needs to have going on in their head. A human being behaves very differently when they're responding to an internal command than they do when they're responding to an external command. So part of the rehearsal process, when the director gives a lot of notes and gives a lot of instructions, is the job of the actors to internalize all of those all that external feedback that they've gotten from the director. I would rather just avoid that by not providing that external feedback and waiting to see what happens and what develops on its own.
Do you sort of make those notes in your head in case it doesn't clear up?
Oh, yeah. I have a little Madame Defarge's list of things that I'm on the lookout for. And if this persists, I will do something about it.
Is that different for young actors than for more experienced actors,
method
you're talking about?
Radically different. Experience is not by itself a panacea. I've worked with very experienced actors who had lots of problems. There are certain qualities, and I've worked with very inexperienced actors who were wonderful, like Talis. There are certain qualities that some people seem to have embedded in their DNA. One is spatial sensitivity, being able to move out of the impulse of that comes from action. If I'm trying to persuade her of something, I'm naturally going to move towards her. Or if I'm mad at her, I'm going to naturally move away. So when an actor has that kind of connection between the impulses they feel and their sense of the use of space to express those changes in relationship, then the blocking just happens on its own. That's one quality.
There's an aspect of acting which is just inhabiting the space naturally. So, you know, this is what Benny's talking about. You can't give the impression that you are going from point A to point B because you were told to go from point A to point B. It's got to be organic. It's got to be integral. You've got to sort of act in a sort of 360-degree sense of where you are and that the space you're occupying is real space and the movements and expressions that you're doing flow organically out of the situation you're in. And if it looks like, a lot of it is mechanical. I mean, a director has to move around and look and see that, you know, that it plays as well from house right as it does from house left, and people are in a pleasing composition. But that's what exactly what Betty's talking about. The actors can't have that as an object. They've got to internalize that and then be alive in that space.
Some directors will use blocking as a way of communicating about the action, what's going on in the scene. If a director says, "All right, I want you to cross right at her at this line," he or she is really saying, "You're attacking her here." And it may be that the experience of that movement will give that actor the experience of what it is that propels that movement. So it's a two-way street. Other qualities that actors need to have almost natively that are almost impossible to train, because I've taught acting for over 50 years, and I just know that there's a lot of stuff that you cannot teach. Either the person's got it or they don't. And one of them is a sensitivity to language. The way in which the act of speaking is an act of externalizing the internal state of the character. That also is a two-way street, because the old British tradition of just say the words had a lot to say, a lot of good in it, because if you just say the words in the fullest sense, if for you the act of speaking is a way of turning yourself inside out so that the voice that emerges into the outer world carries with it the marks of the entire inner organism through which it has passed. Because the voice, after all, starts at a very deep place in the body, travels through all of the big structures, muscular structures of the body, through the articulators, and carries with it the quality of the breath, which after all expresses fundamentally our relationship to our world, the way we take it in and breathe it out again. If speaking is an action that is as complete an expression of the actor's organism as that, then the playwright has a chance of providing linguistic actions. The kinds of... See, a playwright, unlike any other kind of writer, is not writing for a reader. A playwright is writing because someone is going to speak this out loud. And as a result, the playwright's use of rhythm and tonality and imagery is a way for that writer to reach into the organism of the actor through the language. And then the actor, receiving it in that way, turns it around and redelivers it to the audience with every... It's like, you know, Orpheus coming back from the underworld. It carries with it everything that the playwright conceived of it expressing. I like to think of a text, a script, as a kind of residue of an entire state of consciousness, an entire organismic condition. And what the actor has to do is sort of pour into that residue the boiling water of their own emotions and feelings.
There's just on the idea of actors of experience and whether this all becomes second nature, even the greatest actors are still insecure and looking for the right way to do something. And I'll just quickly boil down what is actually a long, shaggy, dogish kind of story involving Sir Ralph Richardson and Sir John Gielgud. And Gielgud was directing Richardson. I can't remember what the play was, but Richardson was fussing and fussing through the entire rehearsal process about an entrance, about his first entrance that he had to make. And he would say, "Now, John, I'm thinking of coming in like this." And he would try different things every night, and he was just driving himself mad with it. Finally, on the night of the final dress, he came out onto the stage before the rehearsal started and said, "John, John..." "Yes, Ralph." He says, I think I've got it. I think I've figured out that entrance. Well, that's very good, Ralph. What are you going to do? He says, I'm just going to come in.
Exactly. And on that note, Jonathan Richards and Benny Benedetti. Benny is founder and artistic director of the Actors Lab. They're on the web at nmactorslab.com. The show Proof, the play Proof by David Auburn, opens on the 26th of May and runs through June 12th at Teatro Paraguas. I want to thank you both so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
It's always fun.
Thanks for listening to the podcast. To support the program, you can go to radiocafe.org. Many thanks to StudioX.com for their technical support and web design.